Well, remember the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Empire? Ah, those were the days. Back then, the US was the sole remaining superpower. America was seemingly invincible. Charles Krauthammer, the distinguished neoconservative commentator who died recently, he put it well in a highly influential essay in Foreign Affairs magazine. According to Krauthammer, the US should, quote, lead a unipolar world, unashamedly laying down the rules of world order and being prepared to enforce them. That was Krauthammer in 1990. However, in the years since the end of the Cold War, the US has fought seven wars. The Gulf, Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Iraq and Syria. And it's been at war for something like 3 out of 4 years during that period. Wars, by the way, that Donald Trump says he opposed. So was the Pax Americana coming to an end well before Trump arrived on the political scene? And what does the end of American global leadership mean for our neighbourhood, the Asia-Pacific, and for Australia? Well, for answers, let's turn to Doug Barndow. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington. He was a special assistant to President Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. Doug, welcome to ABC Radio.
Happy to be on, Tom.
Now, the conventional wisdom in Washington, and this is on left and right, it's one of those few issues that unites politicians in Washington, they blame Trump for dismantling this Pax Americana, or American global leadership since World War II. Is he really the culprit?
Well, no, the American people are tired of it. I mean, what you have here is a system that's basically supported by a bipartisan elite, folks on both sides of the political spectrum. You know, you have an awful lot of people in Washington who spend their time thinking about crusades to send other people on. You know, and the American people are pretty tired of that. They've been spending money, they've been losing lives, and it's not at all clear what the benefit is. I mean, you look today and you think, what does America get out of constant warfare, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Iraq, ad infinitum?
And we should stress, obviously, having been a Reagan advisor and working for a libertarian think tank, you are crudely putting it on the right. But until relatively recently, the arguments you made, they were found mainly on the ideological left, weren't they?
Well, that's right. I mean, what you found with the end of the Cold War is finally some conservatives, you know, Pat Buchanan would be one, for example, who said, wait a minute, we had a big government to fight the Soviets. Why do we still have one when we've gotten rid of the Soviet Union? But an awful lot of people on the right seem to enjoy that position of extraordinary power and came up with new duties. Charles Krauthammer is one, a man of very intelligent, fine writer. Tragically, you know, we lost him recently. But still, you know, their view was now we have, you know, the power to do something new. Let's take advantage of that opportunity. Frankly, that's a very unconservative way of looking at the world.
Yeah, well, leaving aside the Cato Institute and those on the left who question this Pax Americana, am I right in saying that even today, the only really serious political figures who question this American global leadership are really Donald Trump and, say, Bernie Sanders?
That's right. I mean, we had, they say, Ron Paul, who ran, you know, for president, but a small figure. You had Dennis Kucinich on the Democratic side. You have some outliers, people there at the edges. But the central leadership on both Republicans and Democrats seems committed to maintaining this role almost irrespective of cost.
And as you say, the Americans are tired of the world and they're suffering from foreign policy fatigue. My guest is Doug Barndow. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington. The subject, why Trump represents a threat to the American global leadership role that it's played certainly since the end of the Cold War, some will say since the end of World War II, and that's a good thing. Doug, let's turn to Asia. At the Singapore summit, Trump called for a halt to the US-South Korean military exercises. Now, that met overwhelmingly hostile response in Washington, parts of Asia to be sure. Was Trump out of line?
No, I think it made a lot of sense. If you want the North Koreans not to test nuclear weapons and not to test missiles, you really do have to give them something. And I find it extraordinary here in Washington, people who last year were running around saying, oh my goodness, we don't dare let North Korea be able to develop nukes and missiles, are suddenly saying it's more important to keep U.S. you know, troops active there, have exercises, than it is to stop the North Koreans. It shows, I think, a profound misjudgment of priorities where the most important issue for all of us is to try to prevent North Korea from being a nuclear power, we have to be prepared to make concessions. If we don't, why should the North Koreans make an agreement?
But you see, your critics on left and right, Democrat, Republican, they'll say that those drills, those military exercises, have been an integral part of South Korean security for years and a vital negotiating tool with the North Koreans. What has Trump gained from all that?
Well, what Trump has gained is the fact that North Koreans no longer are threatening to turn your other cities into lakes of fire. They're not threatening to shoot missiles, you know, towards Guam, conceivably towards Australia. They're not threatening to kind of build nuclear, missile-tipped missiles that can hit the United States. You know, you've seen a complete change in attitude. And in fact, I talked with a humanitarian activist who came back from a recent trip to North Korea. They've gotten rid of all of the anti-American propaganda. And, I mean, I've been there before. I mean, it was all over. You've seen a real change in attitude there. I'm still skeptical they'll give up their nuclear weapons, but they seem much more oriented now towards a peaceful approach, an economic approach. That's an advantage. It's something that the West can work with and should encourage.
You rarely hear this argument in the mainstream media. I mean, you think about it. What has Kim given up? At least he's halted the nuclear tests. He's halted the missile tests. He's returned those U.S. Hostages. And, of course, he's in the process of releasing the remains of those Americans who died in Korea. In other words, we keep hearing there's no concessions that Pyongyang are making. These are clearly concessions.
That's right. And I think what's important to recognize is Kim, you know, has to, why would Kim want to give up his one, you know, kind of defense mechanism, given the United States' willingness to, you know, attack, invade, bomb other countries, including Libya, which in fact gave up its nuclear weapons and missiles. At the Singapore summit, what Kim did is said he wanted a relationship, a peace regime, and then denuclearization. I think that order was intentional, and it makes sense.
Okay, but Trump also said at Singapore that the U.S. should not have any troops on the Korean Peninsula eventually. He intends at some point to remove them from the peninsula entirely. But that's the stated long-term goal of the Chinese government. I mean, your critics will say, we're just doing China's bidding.
I'd say we're doing America's, you know, kind of duty. I mean, the problem here is there's no reason to assume that military commitment should exist forever, irrespective of changes in the region. South Korea now has something over 50 times the GDP of North Korea. It has, you know, twice the population. I mean, the question is, why should the U.S. forever defend wealthy allies? I mean, Europe raises the same question, and Trump has done that with NATO. I mean, NATO has something like 12 times the GDP of Russia, 3 times the population. Yet, when they're worried about Russia, they expect America to defend them. This is an overhang from 70 years ago. It doesn't make any sense today.
Surely any U.S. retreat, and this is what your critics will say, Doug, they'll say that any U.S. retreat will send a signal that Beijing will be more assertive in the region. Now, to the extent this is true, won't a rising China represent a threat to the status quo in the region?
Well, there's a difference between it representing a threat to the status quo than a threat to the United States. And I'm most important in avoiding a war with a nuclear-armed China. To my mind, the U.S. should be the backup power, the offshore balancer. Countries in the region need to be prepared to do more, and we see that. I mean, we see a kind of a debate that's growing in Japan that's very important. We see India taking on a larger role. We see countries like Vietnam, which are looking for kind of Western support. We see the Philippines saying Japan should do more. We're seeing a transformation there that's driven by concern over China, a well-deserved concern. But again, this shouldn't just be America's job. This is one where countries in the region should be doing more themselves.
And indeed, Tony Abbott, the former Prime Minister, he was recently at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, Doug, and he was a guest on this program recently. And he makes the point, and this is very rare for an Australian politician, but he's saying that the American legions are returning home, and as a result, this is what Abbott said, Australians need to resist adversaries in their own right. That would be your argument too.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the U.S. has a lot in common with countries like Australia. I mean, this is a relationship that goes back a long time. So there should be a cooperative relationship, but there shouldn't be a dependent relationship. And that's especially the case when it comes to South Korea, comes to Japan and other countries. So you're kind of allied countries, democratic countries, countries that have a reason for being concerned about China need to be doing more. And I think we're seeing that. China's policy has actually pushed countries away from it and together. To me, that's all the good.
Okay, well, listen, finally, a trip down memory lane. 20 years ago this week, it was, I think, 1998, I commissioned you to write an article for the Australian Financial Review under the headline, US Alliance with Australia Has Passed Its Use-By Date. This was in mid-1998, and you argue, Doug Barndale, quote, with the threat of war the least serious in a half a century, both countries, Washington, Canberra, should jettison their antiquated alliance created for a different era. Now, it's now been 70 years, Doug. Canberra and Washington are no closer to jettisoning that alliance. Why?
Well, part of that is the status quo is very powerful. That I think folks who are in leadership positions, number one, don't like to make changes because they're afraid of the consequences. And second is, for the most part, certainly in Washington, there's a desire to be involved everywhere. There's a desire to play a leadership role. There's a desire to kind of impose America's will in different ways. And I think from Australia's standpoint, look, if I could rely upon a nuclear armed power to help defend me, why shouldn't I? That I can understand that. And I think that's also, we see that in Tokyo, we see that in Seoul. But the problem, again, is these are relationships that were created in a different age. Originally, we were looking at a revived Japan then. We weren't looking at China. That we need to be thinking in terms of the future and how to keep the relationship current rather than assuming it has to be preserved as it is.
Doug, it's always great to have you on the program.
Tom, thanks. Always enjoy it.